From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Automakers have a change of heart about fuel efficiency standards.
Every major car manufacturer, the CEO stood with President Obama and made this announcement and made this commitment.
What kind of person mixes a nonprofit with a real estate development?
I'm a big believer in the idea that healthy neighborhoods are diverse and inclusive neighborhoods.
We'll talk with a Michigan Women's Hall of Fame honoree about what inspires her.
That was huge. I can say from a personal perspective, to me, that was the greatest thing that I have witnessed in my career.
And our music experts have a wish list for induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
With each new album, she explores a new sound, takes on a new image, and she's done that to great success.
But first, let's get a news update. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Coming up later this hour, we'll learn what equitable development might look like in Detroit. But first, if you've been to a fall festival or really any kind of carnival in the state, chances are there was a booth for Voters Not Politicians. The group is gathering signatures to get a proposal on the ballot. It wants an independent commission to draw the congressional and legislative districts to avoid gerrymandering in districts to favor one party or another. Republicans, the party in power, have been responsible for drawing those maps, and Republicans say Voters Not Politicians is a front group for the Democrats, according to an article out today by Gongwer. Robert LeBrant is among those opposed to Voters Not Politicians proposal, and he's familiar with a new group called People to Protect Voters' Rights. It says instead of ending gerrymandering, the Voters Not Politicians is actually a license to gerrymander. So, to help us clear up some of that confusion, Robert, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, what do you see wrong in the idea of an independent commission drawing the districts instead of politicians drawing the maps?
I don't think there's anything wrong with having an independent redistricting commission. My concerns probably focus on two areas. One, the very convoluted way that an independent redistricting commission gets created. And then the criteria for drawing those districts, when I review the 7 points contained in the criteria, what I find, there really is no criteria. It's what these 13 people that somehow get selected through a kind of random draw decide to adopt. And so with that, let's take a look at the way the commission is to be chosen.
Right, which for some people might be the most controversial part of the proposal.
A number of commentators have said, why are you trying to exclude all of these people from at least application to serve on this independent redistricting commission? One of the problems in this selection process is it's so limited to people who have really no experience, either in government or with political parties. And some would see that to be a virtue. Well, I think all we have to do is take a look at term limits in Michigan to see that inexperience is not necessarily a virtue. Selection on the commission isn't based upon any kind of acquired skill or knowledge.
So who's behind People to Protect Voters' Rights, this new group that wants to stop Voters Not Politicians?
Well, these people probably have some of the same biases, but in reverse, to the people that organized Voters Not Politicians. Katie Fahey, my good friend Walt Sword, and others come from a kind of a Democratic Party background. They've all been contributors to the Democratic Party. And I suspect that the people that will be in opposition to this particular proposal will have some Republican bent to them. The point I wanted to re-stress, besides the convoluted selection process for these 13 people that will be commissioners, they're supposed to have full-time jobs. But they will do this work on the side and get paid about $44,000 a year. The commission itself will get an extra appropriation equal to 25% of the total budget of the Department of State to run this redistricting process. The fact that these 13 people will be basically selected because of their arm's length distance from any kind of partisan activity or any kind of governmental activity. These are the people that are going to be drawing district lines on some very loose criteria that will allow them to kind of draw lines in many different ways. One of the concerns I have is that we're going to abandon counties, cities, and townships as the basic building blocks of districts, and we're going to replace that with a term that no one has defined called communities of interest. So the commission will hold public hearings. Groups will come in and try to pack those public hearings, saying that this is the particular community of interest that we want to see, you know, represented in a map. And, you know, I think that turning redistricting over to community organizers is perhaps one of the worst ways to do redistricting.
Robert LeBrant is a political strategist and has been an advisor to many Republican office holders over the years. Thanks very much for taking time to tell us about this.
Okay, thank you.
Congress is reviewing the Obama administration's fuel efficiency standards. There's been a slew of op-ed pieces with conservative think tanks calling for a rollback of rules that increase fuel efficiency. They'd rather let the market decide, a market that trends toward less efficient trucks and SUVs. Environmental groups are saying we'll save fuel, we'll save money, pollute less, and reduce greenhouse gases that cause climate change with new efficiency rules that were passed by the Obama administration and Congress at one point. Joining us now is former Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Carol Browner. She was also director of the White House Office of Energy and Climate Change Policy during the Obama administration. The auto industry doesn't like the higher standards. Conservatives don't like them. Why do you think we need to continue to require increased fuel efficiency from vehicles?
Well, two reasons. One, it's good for our health. Two, it's good for our pocketbooks. The more efficient your car, the further a tank of gas will go. That means you save money at the pump. And secondly, the more efficient your car, the cleaner your car, the less pollution. You know, we have a lot of people in this country who suffer from asthma, 24 million Americans. You have almost a million people in your state of Michigan who suffer from asthma. And we know that pollution can make an asthma attack worse. So reducing our air pollution just makes common sense. And it can be done in a cost-effective manner.
Help me through the process here. And then reviewing this rule, what are the options before Congress?
Back at the beginning of the Obama administration, I worked with the president, with EPA, with the Department of Transportation, with the car industry. They sat at the table with us, car companies, to craft these rules, to craft this program. And what the car company said is, we need some predictability and certainty. What are you going to ask of us? Give us it over a long time frame so we can make the right investments to get the right innovations, to get the right solutions to pollution. And we did that. These rules have been on the books. And now suddenly you've got both the administration, Scott Pruitt at EPA, the White House, Congress saying, well, maybe not. And, you know, it's a process. They have to either do another rule, which would undo the current requirements, or Congress would have to pass the law. And, you know, so there's an opportunity for citizens to engage. If what you want is cleaner air, a more efficient car, when you buy a new car, you know, a tank of gas that goes further, then you need to raise your voice now, because these changes don't have to be made. They can be stopped. If the public raises their voice, they can be stopped.
One of the criticisms is that the technology required to meet these fuel standards will drive up the price of cars and trucks to the point the average Jane or Joe can't afford to buy a vehicle. How much consideration was that given in creating these fuel efficiency standards?
We looked extensively at what the cost would be. We looked at what the cost to the consumers would be. We looked at what the benefits would be. What would be the benefits of fewer asthma attacks, of fewer premature deaths, of, you know, less violent storms? And what we saw is that the benefits would outweigh the cost. And that is a story that has been told time and time again when we look back at the Clean Air Act and implementation of air pollution standards going back 40 years ago, that, you know, when we set a pollution standard, when we require pollution to be cleaned up, what happens is once that requirement's in place, we find a more cost-effective way to do it. You know, you create a market, right? Someone has to sell the technology that drives down the pollution. There's competition. You know, three people try and sell it, so they make it cheaper. They make it better. And, you know, we can do that again. There is no reason to think we can't end in a place where the air is cleaner and families can save money at the pump.
There's another proposal that's being talked about right now. Two Michigan members of Congress, Republican Fred Upton and Democrat Debbie Dingell, have introduced legislation that would Well, in the end, it would reduce fuel efficiency requirements. That proposal calls for the EPA and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which have these different fuel economy and emissions standards, that those two would have to get together and have just one set of standards. How does that fit into this review of fuel efficiency standards?
That's exactly what we did. That's exactly what we did at the beginning of the Obama administration. We had the car companies come in. We had the state of California. We had EPA, the Department of Transportation. Everybody has different authorities and different responsibilities. And we crafted a national car plan. Every major car manufacturer, the CEO stood with President Obama and made this announcement and made this commitment. We've done that. And now what we need to do is be about implementing it and continuing to implement it so we continue to get progress in more fuel-efficient cars, we continue to get progress towards cleaner air, and we continue to bring the consumer savings at the pump.
Regardless what Congress or the EPA might do, California says it will not budge on the current standards, and about a dozen states follow California's lead. So how does that affect the battle over fuel efficiency standards?
What this means is California will have one set of requirements, half the country will have one set of requirements, and the other half another. It doesn't make any sense for Detroit. It simply doesn't make any sense. They don't want to make two cars. They don't want to sell one car in California and one car somewhere else. So that's why we created in the Obama administration this national car program to give them the certainty to make sure that it was one car for the whole country, that everybody got the benefits. But if they walk away from that, if Congress walks away from that, then you're going to end up in a situation where you have two different cars being manufactured, and that's not good for anybody.
Carol Browner served as EPA administrator during the Clinton administration and was the director of White House Office on Energy and Climate Change Policy during the Obama administration. Thanks for helping us understand this.
Thank you.
Coming up, this year's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominees are in, and Detroit's MC5 is on the list again. What other Detroit artists should be there? Our Detroit music critics will share their picks. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Detroit is rebuilding, and a lot of that is happening in downtown and midtown. Big investments, big returns. But there's another effort. It's smaller in scale, and return on investment is not the first order of business. It's called equitable development. The firm Develop Detroit is a nonprofit following the guidelines of equitable development. Sonia Mays is the CEO, and she joins us now. Let's start from the beginning. Develop Detroit looks at a project, say redeveloping an apartment building. How do you approach that project differently than a typical developer?
One of the very first lenses that my organization uses when we approach projects is whether or not a particular project is going to stabilize and grow and provide opportunity more broadly for the neighborhood, for the local community. And so we start with that lens. So sometimes, you know, if you're looking at an apartment building, particularly in a neighborhood that may be experiencing early growth, maybe we're interested in renovating the apartment in a way that allows existing residents to stay put, but to stay put with a building that captures more modern amenities. Sometimes we're looking at developments, though, that add new elements to the neighborhood. So maybe we're looking at how can we develop in a way that'll add a high-quality early ed center? Or how can we develop in a way to add a food-based business or grocery store in a neighborhood that maybe hasn't had one in a while?
You've received funding from J.P. Morgan Chase, the Ford Foundation, Kresge Foundation. How do you use those funds?
We have such a unique model, one that I think is very appropriate for this moment that we're experiencing, this revitalization moment that we're experiencing here in Detroit. And so our partnership with the local foundations has really been one about starting up an organization. So it's our hope longer term that Develop Detroit will be the type of nonprofit that can actually pay for its own operating expenses out of its real estate activities. Our foundation partners, what they've done is they've said, okay, we understand that it takes a little bit of time to get, you know, real estate developments going. There's a little bit of time before you can start to see the developer fee come in. And so we're willing to support your operations for the 2 to 3 years that it takes to get to that point where you're earning your own income. And so that's the partnership that we have. And, you know, I see it as a win-win. The foundations are helping to create a badly needed resource in Detroit. but they're creating one that ultimately will be able to stand on its own 2 feet and won't be reliant on philanthropy in the long run.
About your approach, why do you think equitable development is important for Detroit?
I'm a big believer in the idea that healthy neighborhoods are diverse and inclusive neighborhoods. I'm a big believer that, particularly in a city where there's a myriad of different experience levels, socioeconomic settings, that we really ought to be looking at building communities that are accessible to a broad group, and not just those who happen to be more or less on the affluent end of the spectrum. So I see it as the right thing to do and the most thoughtful way to invest in how our cities and communities develop. And Detroit has a really interesting and unique moment to tackle some issues. You know, I don't often use the dreaded G word, but to tackle those type of issues that have confounded other cities as they have gone through moments of rapid neighborhood change. We have a moment here where we can build on the experience of other places like Harlem and D.C. and really take a more intentional approach to making sure that everyone can access the good things that are coming out of this moment in real estate development.
It's funny, you mentioned you don't like to talk about the G word. That's my next question. Is this sort of an antidote to gentrification?
I certainly hope so, but that whole conversation is fraught with so many complications and pitfalls. But I think that's exactly right. That's what we're attempting to do. We're saying that, you know, we believe that there's a way, again, to be very intentional and thoughtful and to partner with particularly residents who have been in a community the longest. We're saying that there's an approach here that can be taken that doesn't directly lead to rapid displacement. And if you've looked at this, you know that no one nationally has gotten this exactly right. You know, this is a work in progress is what we like to say internally, but we do deeply believe that there's an approach here that will avoid the worst of the gentrification process.
At the top, I talked about downtown and midtown. I'm wondering, where are your projects going to be, and can you tell us about a couple of them that you're considering?
We actually do have large projects that are located in the midtown and actually Eastern Market District, and those are exciting mixed-use, mixed-income projects where we are also planning on building street-level retail. And so those are sort of your classic urban catalytic projects that pull together a bunch of different disciplines. But we've also been buying properties outside of Detroit's core. And in one neighborhood in particular, in the North End neighborhood, we were able about a year ago to step in and preserve a building that was filled with working Detroiters who were in jeopardy of seeing their rents skyrocket if the property had fallen into the hands of a different type of investor. And we've been able to move forward with a plan for that building to renovate it, to add new units, to create some retail opportunities in the surrounding area, all while having this deep commitment to those who have been living there the longest.
Are they going to see a rent increase because of these improvements?
The week that we took over this particular building that I'm referencing, we went in and held a resident convening in the building, explained who we are, explained our nonprofit model. And what we shared with those residents is that we aim to have a zero displacement policy in that building. And so we're going to operate our development in a way that allows anyone who was in that building on day one, who wants to stay there, we're doing this in a way that we'll be able to offer them a unit that's either new or renovated that's affordable to their particular economic circumstance. In that development's a pretty high-touch process where we're using a range of financing tools to be able to meet that objective.
Sonia Mays is the CEO of Develop Detroit, a nonprofit firm following the guidelines of equitable development. Thanks for telling us about this.
Thanks for your interest, Lester. I really enjoyed being on today.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Every month, we take a little time to learn about and listen to some new music from Detroit area artists. This time, though, something a little different. We're going to look at one band that's been nominated once again for entry into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And then we'll hear about some other bands our guests really want to see in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Our guides, as always, are Paul Young, the founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine, and executive editor Khalid Bhatti. Well, let's start with the nomination. Who is it?
The nomination is MC5, and this will be their third time being nominated. They were nominated last year, which obviously was not successful, and again in 2003. So we're hoping third time's the charm.
Now, MC5 got a lot of attention this year because of the 50th anniversary of the 1967 Detroit uprising. They certainly were not quiet about politics in their music. Fans might have loved it, but how was that received by the powers that be, the record labels, the hitmakers, the radio DJs?
Yeah, they ran into a lot of trouble, and it kind of contributed to some of their lack of success, you know, outside of the Detroit area. But certainly politically charged. They were managed by John Sinclair. He founded the White Panther Party and was really active with the Fifth Estate, which is a anarchist publication based in Detroit. But they, as certainly as revolution as they were with their politics, they were equally as important from a music perspective.
We're going to listen to a little bit of MC5's music. What can you tell us about this song?
Yeah, I think we're going to be listening to Kick Out the Jams, which is the title track of an album recorded in 1968. It was recorded live at Detroit's Grandy Ballroom over Devil's Night and Halloween.
Okay, so MC5, again, third time for nomination into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You guys, though, have some suggestions of Detroit artists you'd like to see nominated for induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Who is it?
Well, the first artist that we picked is someone who veers a little bit off of the narrow definition of rock and roll, but I think the organization has started to, you know, honor some artists that are part of the broader scope of popular music. And the first artist that we chose was Madonna.
Oh, pop star, yeah.
Yeah, actually the queen of pop.
Not the first one to enter in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Not by any long shot, but if you think of pop, you immediately think of a few artists, Michael Jackson being one, but Madonna really crystallized this idea of an artist who borrows from different genres and then makes them palatable for the mainstream. And she's taken on different guises throughout her career. With each new album, she explores a new sound, takes on a new image. And she's done that to great success. And she's brought us many different hits. In fact, she's the biggest selling recording artist, female recording artist of all time, biggest selling touring artist of all time. So she's earned that title of queen.
And of course, that's the song Borderline from Madonna, her fifth single released back in 1984. As I understand the qualification to be nominated, you have to have your first single 25 years ago. She just barely makes that, right? As I recall, I was in college picking music for my college station, and that single for Like a Virgin came out. I think that was probably the first one, right?
Yeah, that was 1984. Her first single was the year I was born, actually. And in fact, I went to the same high school that Madonna went to. It's kind of funny.
You've got another one that probably doesn't qualify because hasn't been around for 25 years. What's your other suggestion?
So our next one here, and we're kind of going in order roughly by era, and that is the White Stripes, which is a very famous rock duo from Detroit, Jack White and Meg White. And they were active from about 1997 to, I guess, officially 2011.
Yeah, it surprises me when somebody says they've been around for 15, 20 years. Because I'm thinking, really? Has it been that long? But yeah, I guess it has.
Yeah, their first album was their debut album was The White Stripes in 1999, and they certainly paid a lot of homage to Detroit specifically. They have songs like The Big Three Killed My Baby, Hotel Yorba, which is named after an actual hotel in Southwest Detroit, and just a lot of hits along the way, but they've certainly evolved their sound. They started with that really kind of punk garage sound, and they really, you know, grew into their own way of exploring, you know, the music. So they're a really interesting group. They really stood out when they came out for the first time, just being a twosome. So this song is called The Hardest Button to Button. It's from 2003 album Elephant, which actually won a Grammy in 2004 for Best Alternative Music Album, and also contains Seven Nation Army, the chorus everyone knows, which won the Grammy that year, of course, for Best Rock Song.
Now we're going to jump ahead to another era. I wasn't as familiar with this artist. Who do you have in mind?
We're going to be listening next to Danny Brown, who actually, on his debut album, The Hybrid, he had a song called White Stripes. So it's a nice callback to the last artist we listened to.
What song are we going to hear?
This is When It Rained from Danny Brown's 2016 album, Atrocity Exhibition.
So I wasn't so familiar with Danny Brown, so I listened to a couple of his songs. And, you know, I fully realize art is sometimes offensive. In the lyrics, we've got explicit sex, violence, misogyny. And he's not the first male artist to include those things in his songs, and I imagine he probably won't be the last either. But what do you think about his work as a body? Why should it be considered for induction into the Hall of Fame?
So that content, that's not okay. And certainly that's not an endorsement of the content. But he has grown in his work, and he doesn't necessarily rap about that to this day. He raps a lot about doing drugs or partying. And if you listen to his interviews or if you talk to him, he often talks about how people misinterpret that as some sort of ringing endorsement for taking drugs. And in fact, he's often mischaracterized as some sort of Lothario or Epicure that loves to, you know, he's a hedonist. But in fact, he's singing about how that exacerbates his depression and mental illness and how he hasn't found solace in those, you know, vices. Certainly he's not any, you know, saint, and we wouldn't call him that. But I think if you look at rap today, it's become a lot more diverse, a lot more varied in its sound. And someone like Danny Brown is, you could point to him as a harbinger of that movement. He certainly points to a lot of different inspirations that are outside of the world of hip hop. For example, nu metal, post-punk, electronic music. And he incorporates those into his music while still remaining technically really proficient at rapping. And he is still able to incorporate like a really po-faced, dead-eyed delivery into his music while incorporating his manic yelp at times, too. He's all over the place. He contains multitudes.
So back to MC5, what are the chances that they'll actually be inducted this year?
You know, I would hope that they would be pretty good. This is their third time being nominated. And, you know, some of their friends, the Stooges, Iggy Pop, who really were alongside them during their incredible run at the Grandy Ballroom and all around Detroit, you know, they made it in. So I would think that the punk world owes a lot to MC5, and I think there's a lot of people that would like to see this proto-punk group where they belong in the Hall of Fame.
That's Paul Young, the founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine, and we heard from Khalid Bhatti, the executive editor. You can check out their work at DetroitMusicMag.com. All right, well, thanks very much, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up next, we will talk to an auto designer for General Motors. She's being added to the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. Plus, members from the Roustabout Theater Troupe are back to help us get in the mood for Halloween. That's in 10 minutes on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Not too long ago, the 2017 class of the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame was announced. Among the honorees was one of GM's top designers, Elizabeth Witzel, and she joins us now. Well, first, congratulations.
Thank you very much, Lester.
All right, let's start with stereotypes. I think a lot of people think about car design and they think about men, but there's an increasingly greater number of women designers in the automotive industry. How did you get interested in designing cars?
Well, actually, I was born and raised in a family of car enthusiasts, and I also had a love for art. So it was kind of a natural that I moved from becoming an artist to becoming an automotive designer. My dad actually worked for General Motors, and he noticed my passion for art, and he encouraged it. But he said, you know, you really should take a look at automotive design as a career, because I've been in the design studios and I don't see very many women, and I think that might be a really good opportunity, especially since you love cars. He was right. And I studied industrial design, but I ended up coming to General Motors, and that's how it all started.
So tell me what your position is today. What do you do?
Today I am a design director, and I am responsible for what we call the User Experience Studio. And what we work on are all of the interface elements on the interior. So we do the steering wheel, we do the shifters, we do the instrument clusters, we do what we call the center stack, which has all your radio, your navigation, your climate controls. All the electronic bits and pieces we call the interface elements is what we do. So it's a very exciting place right now, because that's where a lot of the invention is happening on interiors for cars.
Right, a lot of changes going on, too. And some complaints recently, I understand, about how complex it can be and how much you have to take your eyes off the road. How much do you have to know about people in order to do this job right?
Oh, we have to know everything about our customer. So before we even begin, we know who our customers are. And as you know, we have several brands at GM. And within those brands, there are customers within those brands, different customers. So we know exactly who they are. We do a lot of research on who our customer is, the needs that they have, the lifestyle they live. So we design around the customer. The customer is really the center of everything we do. So while we're designing, though, we double check. We take our proposals out, and we get feedback directly from those customers. And we make changes accordingly. So, yeah, customers are very much a part of the process and the voice of what we end up with in the design at the end of the day.
So tell me some of your work in a make and model that's on the road right now that you're most proud of working on.
I just finished recently the Buick Enclave. It's a model year 2018. It'll be hitting the showrooms soon. I love that project. I always love the last one I worked on for some reason.
Well, I bet. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that one, actually, we just won an award for that. We won a User Experience Award, one of the top 10 in the industry from Ward's Auto Interiors. So very proud of that. But that was a great project because the Enclave was one that you know, the current product on the road, it does very, very well. It's very loved by its current customers. So the challenge was, how do we beat that? How do we make that even better? And so we listened to the customer. We implemented those changes. And hopefully when it comes out on the road, that will be something that our customers love even more.
Last year, I sat down with retiring GM Global Design Chief Ed Wellborn. He retired the highest-ranking African-American executive at any auto company worldwide. And during that interview, he talked a lot about encouraging diversity. How true is that within GM's corporate culture?
Very true. We have such a diverse workforce here at GM. You know that we're a global company, and so the talent that we attract comes from all over the world, and we look for the best and brightest. And I can tell you, any studio that you go in, you can see people from different countries, different cultures, different ethnic backgrounds. It is extremely diverse right now, and that is a major milestone from when I started over 30 years ago. It has completely changed, and the people here are excellent. They are bright, they're passionate, they're enthusiastic. It's so great to see these different perspectives, and the value that diversity brings is so great for us as a company, and it's best for the customer in the end because they bring in such a great point of view, and their talents are so amazing that we end up with better product at the end of the day.
With Mary Barra as the CEO of GM, I'm wondering what message that sent to women in the automotive industry.
That was huge. I can say from a personal perspective, to me, that was the greatest thing that I have witnessed in my career. Mary is a total inspiration. And I've watched Mary in my career. She's 2 years senior to me, and I've watched her. I've seen her on her track in her profession, in her career here. And you know that she worked really hard to get to where she is. As a woman, you, in the beginning, back in the days, 30 years ago, you really had to outperform. You really had to do more and go above and beyond just to get the attention and get the respect of the men around you. And she did that and more. And she's got us on a path that has a higher purpose. Where she's taking GM is so exciting. I come into work every day so energized by her vision, and I am so proud of her. That is a major milestone, not for just GM, but for the whole industry.
We've all heard about the need for more STEM students, that is, students of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. You encourage something called STEAM students with an A. What's that?
STEAM. A is the art. And in fact, STEM is turning into STEAM. It's not just GM. It's industry-wide. They have officially added the A in STEM. So A is the artist, and it is there to bring about the creative mind. And creativity, of course, it's in the field that I'm in design. In design, we have engineers, we have designers, we have sculptors, we have animators. All those people can use the A in art, the creative mind, to help them create better products at the end of the day. The A is, I am so excited about it because even engineers, can be creative. To not have that there in the beginning was shocking. I'm glad it's there now.
I understand GM has lots of creative types from places like Disney and Hollywood. I also know that, you know, people who think those creative types have to deal with engineers, and that might be intimidating for some, or at least restricting in some ways. How does that dynamic work?
It works very well. It's a good balance. Designers, they do bring in a very creative perspective and are always pushing the envelope. But at the same time, you know, the engineers help us to make sure that it gets implemented. At the end of the day, the product is better for it. Now, we do have, you know, we have engineers who are creative as well. To have those creative engineers part of the process just makes our lives a lot easier because we're all moving in the same direction. We all have the same goals in mind. And when you have creative engineering who can help understand how to make the vision of the designer come to life, it's a wonderful thing.
Now, putting it all together, I understand there's a GM car design competition that you're really happy with. What's that all about?
Yes, we work with Car Design News. Every year we have a contest with them, and we provide a brief, a creative brief for students to come up with a certain car design. It changes every year. Sometimes it's a Buick. This year it's going to be a Cadillac. We're going to be launching that later on this fall. And what that does, it's a great platform for the students to show their creativity, show their skills. We mentor them in the process so they have the ability to meet real industry professionals from General Motors, and we help guide them on their choices, on their designs, give them some mentoring. So it's a learning process for them, and it's great for us because what we get out of it is very creative ideas, and hopefully what we get is the people that are really good come and work for us in the future. It's one of those means for us to bring people in, to let people know of this profession of automotive design, and to prepare them as they go through school, and then when they graduate, they have a great portfolio and can get into General Motors. So it's a great program, and we've been doing it, I think, for at least 10 years, and it's been very successful. We've hired people right from that program.
So I've got one more question. What went through your head when you found out you were being inducted into the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame?
You know, I was extremely humbled, honored, and excited. Excited being a born and raised Michigan gal, to be associated with those amazing women who have done so much for other women and humanity in general. To be associated with that group, it just is so humbling to me, and I am so grateful and honored, and I am so proud of the Michigan Historical Society and the things that they're doing to get the word out, to celebrate those wins for women, and to make sure people know, and to keep celebrating those accomplishments that women are making every day. And it's just a wonderful thing, and I'm just so proud to be associated with it. And what I hope to get out of this is to be able to continue the platform that that we have here to make women aware of design as a profession, and to encourage them to think of it as a career choice. Like I said before, not many women know about it. So I encourage parents, if you're out there listening, aunts and uncles, if you're out there listening, if you have a niece or a daughter who is creative, really to think about automotive design as a career. There is so much going on right now in this field, in the auto industry. You know, I wish I was 20 years younger. This is such an exciting industry right now. The amount of innovation and invention that is happening, it's exponential. Every day I walk into work, I am so excited about where we're going as an industry. So if you've got a young daughter or a niece, or if you are young and you're a woman and you're listening, please, please take that into account and check into the auto industry and design, because there is still the need for women here. There's still a lot of opportunity for women to come and be successful in this industry.
Liz Wetzel is an automotive designer at GM and among the 2017 class of the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. Again, congratulations, and thanks for taking a moment with us.
Thank you so much, Lester, for enabling me to get the word out there. I really appreciate it.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Scary, mysterious radio dramas. There's just something about hearing a creepy story with all the sound effects and the trembling voices, forcing your imagination to go places you might not want to go. The Roustabout Theater Troupe seems to agree. On Saturday at Livonia's Trinity House Theater, the troupe's Dark Ride Radio Hour will bring four original radio plays to life and death. I mean, this is Halloween, right? The group stopped by our studios to perform an excerpt of one of their stories called Dolly. A little warning, just for those of you who get easily creeped out.
On October 3, 2015, Jennifer Lindsay Cole was abducted from her home between the hours of midnight and 6 a.m. There were no signs of forced entry, the windows were locked from the inside, and the only item missing was the girl's doll. Jennifer was 8 years old at the time of her disappearance. On August 13, 2017, Jennifer's mother, one Nancy Ellen Cole, heard a noise in the girl's room. Upon investigation, she found her daughter collapsed in the southwest corner of the room. except that Jennifer was now approximately 30 years old. DNA testing confirmed that this woman is in fact Jennifer Cole. As of yet, there is no explanation for either her disappearance or her rapid aging. Medical examiners have ruled out progeria, and the girl, the woman, Jennifer, has remained almost completely unresponsive since her return. The state has brought me in to try and reach her. Jennifer? My name. You don't have to be scared. I just want to talk to you, okay? I brought you something.
What?
If you come back to this table, I'll give it to you. Does that sound all right?
Don't hurt me.
I won't. I promise.
You have to swear.
You want me to swear?
Yeah.
Shoot, dang, heck. I swear I won't hurt you.
No needles?
No needles, no anything at all. I just want to talk.
I don't want to.
Not even if I give you a present?
What is it?
Don't you want to open it? I bet you want to open it.
It's a dolly.
Just like the one you used to have, right? Your mom said...
Are you my mommy?
When they found you again, you didn't have your doll. I thought...
Not mine. Not my dolly.
I'm sorry. It's the same brand.
Not my dolly.
I'm sorry. Truly. I only... You've been through a lot, Jennifer. I just thought you might like a present.
It was nice. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Now... Something very unusual has happened to you, Jennifer. Can we talk about that?
You mean because I'm old now?
Yes.
It's because it's different there.
Where? Where you were taken?
Yeah.
Where was that?
The other place.
The other place?
Yeah.
Do you know where that is? This place?
No one does.
Then how did you get back? Just tell me about the other place, please.
I can't.
Why?
Because they might hear.
Who? Who might hear?
You don't... There are holes. Holes between here and there. You can't see them, but they're real. And what if there's a hole here? They could be listening and...
The people who took you?
They're not people. They're not people.
Then what are they?
They live under my bed.
Are you my mommy?
I would hide under my blanket, but it didn't work. They found me. I dropped my dolly. She fell under my bed, and when I tried to pick her up, I was there a real long time, and the things there, they're real scary. They don't look like us.
What do they look like?
I can't tell you.
How about you draw one for me, okay? Would that be okay, sweetheart?
Yeah.
Can I see? Oh. Oh, my God.
They grabbed me. Took me to the place under the bed. I don't know how long I was there, but I think maybe it was forever. And they did things to me. Things that hurt, and they wouldn't let me have my dolly.
This... What is this?
The things that live in the other place. I'm sorry, I know they're real scary.
No, I shouldn't have done that. I just... Doesn't matter.
That was the Rostabaugh Theater Troupe performing an excerpt from the Dark Ride Radio Hour. You can find out how that story ends and catch three more stories this Saturday at the Trinity House Theater in Livonia. For more information, go to stateside@michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Daniel Pryor. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.